Chapter 16. Reunion. The man spends the rest of the day staring at the rabbit's makeshift grave. He even sits with his back to most of the clearing so that the overturned dirt is laid out directly before him. Yusuf busies himself grooming the horses and caring for his weapons, listening for approaching footsteps or hooves. As the day grows warmer, he brings the man food and his refilled water skin, careful to approach from the side so as not to creep up on him. Though the man won't accept it from his hands, he picks up the water skin almost as soon as Yusuf sets it on the ground, guzzling from it as thirstily as ever. The hours pass, and Yusuf grows more and more twitchy with no sign of Andromache or Quinn. Over their months together, Yusuf has come to accept that the women are capable of so much more than he could ever imagine. They always have something new to tell him. With Andromache, the lesson is usually wordless, only providing clues for him to figure out on his own, or, more often, amused judgment and advice offered only after he has already made a mistake. Quinn is more impatient in some things than her beloved, but she's also more excited to pass on skills and tricks to Yusuf. He has spent long days training with weaponry, with horses, with tracking and subterfuge. He has passed long nights listening to tales of ancient history, enraptured with the pictures the women paint over the campfire, amazed by the things they've seen and done. Still, Yusuf worries for them. It is to his great relief, then, that he hears hoofbeats approaching as night begins to fall. He draws his sword, of course. He is not wholly an idiot. At the noise, the man looks up from his contemplation of the rabbit's grave, clambering to his feet. Andromache's horse is the first into the clearing, closely followed by Quinn's. Their riders look tired but whole, and the ball of anxiety begins to unravel in Yusuf's stomach. "Finally," he says with a wide grin to cover his relief. He gladly resheathes his sword. Before her horse even draws to a halt, Quinn is leaping from the saddle. "You're alive," she calls happily, darting over to throw herself at Yusuf. She snickers when he stumbles back, his arms automatically coming up to wrap around her back. "Hello to you too," he laughs, giving her a tight squeeze before letting go to look her up and down. She smells like she's been riding hard for 2 days, and dried blood flecks her throat and face, but her sunny smile reassures him that all is well. "It's good to see you both. I was just beginning to worry." Andromache swings down from her mount. "Worried about us? How sweet," she drawls, greeting him with a smile. There's a smear of blood on her cheek, but otherwise she looks unruffled. "And here we thought we were supposed to be worrying about you." "No, no," Yusuf says, glancing around for the man he's been keeping awkward company with. "We've been fine." Surprisingly, the man isn't hiding behind his horse. He stands with his back to the bushes, nearly pressing himself into the shrubbery. He's watching their interaction warily. He has somehow found the dagger again. He clutches it tightly in his fist, his arm tense at his side. Ignoring the blade, Quinn approaches the man with far less aggressive energy but no less of a smile. "How have you been?" she asks him directly, stopping just out of arm's reach. "He still hasn't spoken," Yusuf says. Quinn shoots him a glare. "Don't interrupt, it's rude." Turning back to the man, she smiles again and repeats her question in Dutch, then Latin, and so on with several languages Yusuf doesn't speak. The man watches her without reply. His narrowed eyes and furrowed brow fade away as he listens, his face relaxing into blankness. His head tilts slightly to one side in what Yusuf is quickly realizing is a habit of his. It's a surprisingly endearing mannerism. Distracted, Yusuf startles when a hand firmly claps his shoulder. "Help me with the horses?" Andromache half asks, half orders. Without waiting for an answer, she starts leading her mount towards where Yusuf has hobbled the other two. Yusuf takes the other horse's lead and follows. "How is he?" Andromache asks lowly as soon as they're out of earshot. Yusuf puffs at his cheeks, blowing out a long exhale. "I don't know. He hasn't run away yet." "That's a start." Busying himself with the horse's gear, Yusuf tries to compile the words for the last couple of days. "He fell asleep on the way here," he starts, and then he can't seem to stop. I had to pretend I wasn't watching to get him to lie down in his bedroll, and the same thing the next morning to get him to eat. He followed me to the river but wouldn't let go of the dagger, so I tried to wash him and I fucked up, Andromache, but he still stayed. And today there was a rabbit. As suddenly as they began, the words cut off. His eyes flick over to the fresh dirt of the little grave. Andromache follows his gaze, frowning. What about a rabbit? He killed it. Yusuf shakes his head. He's not explaining any of this well, babbling like a child. It's the relief of having someone else to share this with, loosening his tongue and spilling words out without thought. It was badly injured in a trap nearby. He meets Andromache's eyes. You remember how you killed him? He asks grimly. Understanding dawns on her face, but her frown doesn't lessen. Yes. They both turn to look at where Quinn and the man are still deep in one-sided conversation. Quinn looks cheerful, her hands flitting through the air as she regales the man with some tale, possibly of her and Andromache's escape from Gabor's men. The man watches passively, his shoulders rounded just slightly, a habitual protectiveness, Yusuf imagines, rather than an active one at the moment. It's nice to see him so unguarded. Quinn generally has that effect on people when she's feeling friendly. What did you fuck up? Andromache asks, bluntly, without looking away. Yusuf grimaces. I was just trying to clean him off. His eyes scan down the man's form as he thinks of the gore still lingering beneath those clothes. I managed to... Well, I made him let me stand behind him, he admits, and I was washing his back, but as soon as I moved below his shoulder blades, he reacted strongly. She hums tonelessly. Either of you die? What? No. He barely scratched me with the blade. Glancing at him with a quirk of her lips, Andromache turns back to her horse. Must not have been that bad, then. It was bad, Yusuf insists, hands clenching at his sides. He thought I was going to hurt him, Andromache, and I nearly did. I pushed him too far, was forceful when I should have let him set his boundaries. It was bad. Smile gone, Andromache sighs and doesn't answer right away. She finishes untying her bedroll from the saddle, then goes to do the same with Quinn's. All right, so it was bad. What do you want me to say? I don't know. Just take this seriously. Andromache's head whips around. I am taking this seriously, she says warningly, her expression hard as stone. Do not presume to know my thoughts, Yusuf. He says nothing, startled at the intensity of her response. Andromache turns away and stares unseeingly into the bushes for several tense moments. Yusuf watches her twist the braid of rope between her hands. I can't put my rage into words, she says quietly, but it's eating away at me. I could burn down this whole forest with it. Her eyes pin him in place when she looks at him, all her millennia weighing on her shoulders. I'm angry, Yusuf. Angry at what was done to him, to one of us. Angry that he isn't free of it, even though we've freed him. But it doesn't help him to be angry. Yusuf droops under her ageless gaze. No, he agrees. It doesn't. He scrubs a hand over his face. I wish I knew what would help. She reaches over to clap another hand on his shoulder. We'll figure it out. Talking to him, treating him like a real person, that's the best we can start with. Yusuf nudges her out of the way and starts untying Quinn's bedroll himself, his fingers itching to do something. I have been talking to him, he says. He listens, but he doesn't understand, except he recognized Al-Quds. You talked to him about Al-Quds? Andromache asked, eyebrow raised. Well, not really. It just sort of came up in passing. Mm-hmm. She lets her eyebrow down, but the skepticism remains. You know you won't get any answers or apologies from him right now. He tosses her a scowl. Yes, I know. I wasn't trying to start a fight. Give me a little more credit, please. She just shrugs. Yusuf points with his chin. He doesn't seem to mind Quinn, he comments. I wonder if she found a language he understands. Maybe, Andromache studies the man. He hasn't said a word. Well, Yusuf says, blinking as he remembers, maybe just one. He absently cradles the bedroll to his chest. He had a nightmare. He was saying, no. I thought it sounded like Occitan, but not quite. Andromache hums thoughtfully and starts walking back towards the other two. Tuscan, maybe. Or maybe he was actually saying null. That could be a few other things. Do you speak any? Some. With Andromache, that could mean she's fluent, but it could also mean she can only ask where to find the nearest bar. Yusuf supposes he'll find out eventually. The man's eyes flick away from Quinn as they approach, glancing over Yusuf and settling on Andromache. He adjusts his grip on the dagger, but doesn't move it from his side. Andromache stops well out of reach. Salut, she says, her stance loose and her hands empty. The man blinks at her. Already did that one, Quinn says, shrugging one shoulder. He's hard to read. I'm not sure if he recognized any of the languages I've tried so far. Excellent, Yusuf sighs. How are we supposed to get him to trust us if he can't understand us? We got him this far, didn't we? Quinn points out. She sends the man another blinding smile that he doesn't seem to know what to do with. Besides, words are useless when it comes to trust. We need action and time, Andromache agrees, and I need food. They eat on their bedrolls, laying them out in a square. The women's exhaustion grows more evident once they're sitting down. Quinn inhales her food and promptly begins nodding off while still upright. Andromache chews her food stoically, but her dead-eyed stare at the ground betrays her weariness. The man keeps a cautious eye on all three of them in turn as he eats the portion Yusuf placed in front of him. Yusuf wants to just let them sleep, but he needs to know what they're thinking. So, he clears his throat. Quinn jerks awake again, startling a flinch from the man. Do we leave in the morning? Andromache nods tiredly, making circles in the air with her finger. We led them on a merry chase in the wrong direction, but it isn't safe to stay here. Where will we go? Quinn laughs lightly. Away. Yusuf shoots her a half-hearted glare for the purposefully vague answer, but he doesn't bother to push. The women will lead them where they will. He is content to follow them. Hopefully the man feels the same. I don't think we should travel too much, Yusuf says. He glances over at the man, who is watching the conversation intently. Their eyes hold for a brief, heavy moment before Yusuf looks away. Once we get far enough away, I mean, he needs to settle somewhere quiet and peaceful. Or maybe he needs open spaces and stimulation, Andromache counters. She shakes her head. Let's just see how he does with the traveling first. We won't be able to stop anywhere near here. Quinn turns to address the man. How does that sound? Are you up for more riding? She tilts her head in the same way he does, smiling encouragingly as she repeats the question in several languages. He watches her without responding. Quinn points at the horses, but he tenses and refuses to turn his gaze away. He likes the horses, Yusuf says softly. His eyes are on the man's large hands as he thinks of the gentle way they'd combed his horse's mane and cradled the rabbit. He rode fine on the way here, fell asleep in the saddle even, and he's been spending most of his time with his horse. Definitely likes her more than me. He huffs a laugh to cover the tinge of envy that comes out of nowhere. The women hear it anyway. Quinn leans over to pat his hand sympathetically. They all know why the man might prefer animal company to human, and none of them blame him. It would be ridiculous to take it personally. And yet, he'll come around. Quinn reassures him with the confidence Yusuf doesn't feel. No one can resist your charms, little brother. He chuckles and gives her a mock bow. Much appreciated. The smile slips away. But there is a lot of history to put behind him, including between us. Andromache snorts quietly. History, she scoffs with a sharp smile. History is nothing to us. We surpass history. She gentles her expression before turning to the man, who seems to simultaneously straighten and shrink at her attention. He will get past it. Yusuf looks at the man, still dirty and bedraggled and far too thin. He's sitting nearly within arm's reach of the women, watchful but not running, cautious but not lashing out. His docile behavior could be entirely due to his fear of punishment, but maybe there is a small semblance of trust creeping in. They can only hope. Done with conversation, the women push their bedrolls together and flop down unceremoniously. The man watches them with wide, curious eyes as they tangle their limbs together with the familiarity of centuries. Yusuf settles in more slowly, keeping an eye on him and wondering yet again what's going through his head. He waits for the man to lie down on his own bedroll. Only then, after the man wraps his arms around himself and lets out a barely audible sigh, does Yusuf close his eyes. Chapter 17. The True Beast. Trigger warning for animal death. Trigger warning for graphic violence. Morning dawns quiet and gentle, soft sunlight fluttering down through the air to rest on blades of grass and stirring bodies. Yusuf yawns and sits up to stretch his arms out. He feels revived, made anew. The four of them are together and everything is looking optimistic. His heart feels light. Andromache is already up, sitting cross-legged on her bedroll as she sharpens her axe. She nods a good morning to him. Quinn slumbers on at her side, grumpily hiding her face in Andromache's thigh as the sun reaches her eyes. The man's bedroll is empty. Yusuf shoves down his instinctual panic and looks first to the horses. Sure enough, he's there, once again finger-combing his patient horse's mane while keeping one eye on the three of them. "Was he awake when you woke up?" Yusuf asks in a voice still rough with sleep. Andromache hums an affirmative, lifting her axe to inspect the blade more closely. She nods to herself, satisfied, and slides it back into its sheath. "He can always sleep on the horse again," she says. "I suppose." Yusuf takes advantage of the women's presence to finally leave the clearing for more than a few seconds, allowing himself a leisurely handful of minutes in the bushes. The man is watching the clearing entrance when he returns. Yusuf smiles at him and tells himself he isn't bothered when the man only looks away. Andromache bullies Quinn into waking, half bribing her with breakfast. They eat as they pack up, chewing mouthfuls of dried fruit and meat in between tying their bedrolls and adjusting their horses' gear. With his share of food stashed in his mouth and one hand, the man retreats to an unoccupied section of the clearing to watch as he eats. Yusuf's dagger is in his other hand, but he holds it loosely. Yusuf makes a mental note to find him a belt. Before long, they're ready to go. Andromache and Quinn mount first, leaving Yusuf to corral the man into the saddle. It doesn't take much doing. Once the women move towards the gap in the underbrush, the man naturally gravitates back to his horse, and at Yusuf's urging he mounts, with slightly more grace this time, still holding the dagger aloft. He reaches out and grips the reins with his other hand. Yusuf decides to let him. He's never seen better horse riders than Quinn or Andromache. They can chase the man down easily if he ends up bolting. Better to trust him with his own horse than lead him like a leashed animal. He swings up onto his own horse and casts a quick look around the clearing. It feels like a lot has happened here in only a few days. He's almost sad to leave its shelter. They ride out quietly. Andromache leads, Quinn just behind her. The man hesitates, looking from their backs to Yusuf. At Yusuf's nod, the man slowly urges his horse forward with a gentle tap of his heels. Yusuf falls in behind him. Soon they will be away from here, and Quinn can sing while they ride. Yusuf will tell terrible jokes just to make Andromache curse at him, and he'll serve as judge for the women's impromptu races. He wonders where the man will fit into their usual traveling routine. But for the time being, they walk in silence, broken only by their horses' hooves upon the plants and birdsong from the trees. They're careful to pick their way through the brush, and avoid natural pathways. The man keeps glancing back as though to check that Yusuf is still there. It's during one of those glances that Yusuf first realizes something is wrong. The man's gaze shifts to beyond Yusuf, his jaw clenching and head cocking to one side. The birds have fallen silent. Quinn, Yusuf calls quietly. She takes one look at his face and halts her horse, focusing intently. The next moment, she's spurring her mount onward again. Quickly, she says. Yusuf speeds his horse to a trot, slowing at the man's side until he does the same. The man's face is tight and anxious. They move through the woods as quickly as they can without risking a broken ankle, but they're hindered by the thick underbrush and their attempts to remain somewhat quiet. In the distance, Yusuf hears noise. It's getting closer. They reach a cluster of thorny bushes and have to backtrack. It isn't until Andromache draws her axe that Yusuf realizes they aren't going to get away. The dogs reach them first. They burst through the underbrush and sprint straight toward them without pause, baying triumphantly. Yusuf counts four at his first glance at the sleek, dark brown shapes hurtling closer, and then the dogs are upon them. Yusuf sees the scene unfold in flashes. Andromache swings out her axe to warn a snapping dog away from her horse's legs. Quinn kicks out with a well-aimed heel as she knocks an arrow, and a yelp splits the air. Two dogs flank Yusuf's mount and hold their ground, snarling and ready to leap. Worst of all, the man's horse whinnies and rears, throwing the man to the ground before it bolts. "Watch out!" Yusuf yells, sword in hand, urging his horse to the side to offer the man some protection. A dog is already lunging for the man, sprawled in the grass, and Yusuf leans over and swings his sword out to meet it. The dog whines sharply as the blade slices across its chest. It backs away several paces, blood matting its fur. Yusuf resists the urge to swing down from his horse and help the man up. "Are you all right?" he calls down, keeping an eye on the dogs, ringing them in. The man hasn't moved to stand. He huddles on the ground, his dagger in hand and his eyes wide and petrified. The dogs bark, and the man flinches. Gabor said he held dogfights, Yusuf remembers suddenly. If Gabor would throw the man into an arena with a bear, he would certainly do the same with a pack of dogs. "Yusuf," Andromache warns, backing her horse up. Quinn spurs her mount to the man's other side, so the three of them encircle him. Yusuf follows Andromache's gaze to the spot where the dogs emerged. Over the growling of the hunting animals, he can hear voices calling out to each other and the stamping of feet, snapping sticks and crumpling bushes. Moments later, the men appear. A dozen men, dressed in guard uniforms, spill out into the open. They quickly surround the group, snapping at the dogs to get back. Half of them hold crossbows at the ready, while the others wield spears or swords. The dogs back up but continue to bay loudly to the guard's clear distraction. Yusuf risks a glance to check on the man, still hunched into himself on the ground. Surprisingly, he's not watching the dogs or the guards. He's not looking at anything in particular, his bright eyes staring into the distance without focus. His chest moves rapidly with his out-of-control breathing. Yusuf is reminded of the rabbit in its trap. He adjusts his grip on his sword as anger burns through him. They will not have him again. He turns back to the guards and grits his teeth, ready for their attack. "Someone go get that horse back," one of the guards orders over the noise of the dogs, gesturing in the direction of the frightened horse's escape. "It's one of ours." One of the crossbow guards peels off from the rest, slinging his weapon over his shoulder and starting to trot away into the trampled undergrowth. "Take the mongrels with you," shouts a familiar voice. "I will beat silence into them later." An enormous horse stomps into view, Lord Gabor seated comfortably in its saddle. Arrogant to a fault, he wears his usual finery instead of armor, his souvenir sword at his hip. The horse snorts as Gabor pulls it to a halt, pawing at the ground with a massive hoof. The guard whistles for the dogs and soon disappears from sight, the noise rapidly vanishing with him. In the sudden silence, Gabor leisurely takes in the scene before him. A satisfied smirk stretches across his face, but his eyes are ice cold. "Now then," he drawls, "what are my esteemed guests doing in my woods? with one of my possessions. Quinn spits in his direction. He is no possession, she hisses, aiming her bow directly at Gabor. Yusuf sucks in a sharp breath and holds it. Ah-ah, Gabor cautions, waggling a finger. He glances pointedly to his guards with their trained crossbows. I do not wish to kill you, lady. Not before I have my answers. But rest assured, if you loose an arrow, all four of you will be dead before it lands. His smile widens unpleasantly. Is this truly worth dying for? It would no doubt surprise Gabor to learn that the answer is yes. Andromache and Quinn have died countless times. The list of what they're willing to die for, what they have died for, has been written over the course of thousands of years. Yusuf has probably only died a few dozen times, most of which happened in the span of a few terrible days in Al-Quds. But even he has begun to grow accustomed to the impermanence of death. Dying to protect someone, or to kill a madman who likes to play with people's lives, absolutely worth it. However, everyone here is well aware of the man's perpetual healing. If all four of them die under a hail of crossbow bolts and then revive, without even the advantage of a surprise, Gabor will stop at nothing to capture them all. Yusuf lets out a long exhale when Quinn lowers her bow, her expression murderous. Foolishly, the guards let their crossbows dip down in mimicry instead of keeping them pointed directly at their targets. Undisciplined indeed. Better, Gabor says. Now, I will be taking him back with me. He doesn't even look at the man. I know what an exciting prize he is, and I can understand not being able to resist taking him for yourself. But with him back in my possession, unharmed, as he always is, I would like to let you go, ladies, lord. He nods politely to each of them in turn, as though they're chatting at his banquet table, instead of moments from bloodshed in the woods. Then his gaze hardens. But I am very put out at your timing. Did we ruin your festival? Quinn bites out, her lips stretched in something that would never pass for a smile. Yes, Gabor snaps, twisting the reins in his hands. You did. His horse dances forward a few steps, and he jerks it back to a halt with a curse. His guards shuffle nervously in place. My guests have been very disappointed by the disruption, not to mention the lack of special performances. I find I do not much care about your guests, Andromache says sharply, nor your festival. She raises her chin. He is done performing for you. No, he is not. As the women and Gabor glare at each other, Yusuf takes another moment to check on the man they're arguing over. He's still crouched in their ring of horses. His gaze is no longer unfocused. He's staring intently at Gabor from behind Andromache's horse, his face twisted with hatred. But looking at the desperate grip he has on the dagger, and the way he shrinks back as though he could merge with the ground, Yusuf sees fear there, too. Hand him over, Gabor says suddenly. Step aside, and I will let you go free, never to return to my lands. Andromache doesn't take her eyes off him. Yusuf, she says. Gabor frowns, narrowing his eyes. In Quinn's native tongue, Andromache says simply, get down. Before anyone can so much as blink, Quinn raises her bow, draws, and fires. A hoarse yell pierces the air. The guards hastily raise their crossbows. Yusuf launches himself off his horse to land, stumbling in front of the crouching man. He holds his sword at the ready, half squatting to keep below the cover of the horses. Andromache and Quinn leap from their mounts directly into the fray. Quinn draws her sword for close-quarter fighting. Andromache has her axe in hand, and the two of them move through a timeless bloody dance they have perfected over many years together. The whirr of flying crossbow bolts, the clashing of steel, and the screams of dying men fill the air. They don't let a single man get through. Yusuf circles the man defensively, but no attacker arrives. Past the restlessly shifting horses, he can catch glimpses of blades flashing and brilliant splashes of blood. Bodies fall to the ground all around him. Turning to scan behind him, Yusuf meets the man's bright eyes for a moment and offers him a nod in reassurance. The man's gaze darts away and his eyes widen at something off to the side. Yusuf whirls back around, stepping into the man's line of sight as he does, just in time. A crossbow bolt buries itself in Yusuf's hip instead of the man's skull, its impact heavy enough to knock him back several steps until his feet bump against the man behind him. Yusuf braces himself and yanks the bolt out with a hard tug and a grunt of pain, dropping it to the ground. The offending crossbowman falls to Andromache's axe as Yusuf's wound closes up. As suddenly as it began, it's over. Yusuf hears one last squelching sound and a choked cry before silence falls. Quinn weaves her way between two of the horses, her grim face splattered in blood and her sword dripping. "All right," she asks, her gaze flicking from Yusuf's face to the bloodied spot on his clothes, to the man huddled behind him. "We're all right," Yusuf glances back. The man's face is pale and drawn, his eyes locked on Quinn's sword. She crouches to wipe it on the grass before sheathing it and showing her open hands. "There," she says, finding a smile for him. "It's over." She speaks too soon. A bark rings out, startling Yusuf and making the man flinch. Quinn scowls and reaches for her bow. "What in the—" A single guard emerges from the woods, staring aghast at the bloody scene. Their stolen horse trails behind him, and the dogs trot by his side. He doesn't manage to get his crossbow back off his shoulder before an arrow sprouts from his heart. He topples, a surprised look frozen on his face. Without orders, the dogs mill about confusedly, growling and snapping at the air. "Go!" Andromache's voice rings out commandingly. One of the dogs whines and retreats into the bushes, but the rest bark more aggressively in reply. Quinn sighs and sets another arrow to her bow. The biggest dog comes to a decision and leaps forward. It goes down with a shot to the eye. That gets the rest of the dogs to hesitate, and Andromache striding forward with her axe already swinging is enough to get them to scatter. "They might be back," Quinn warns, watching them go. "We'll deal with it then," Andromache says. "We won't be long here anyway." She scans the carnage with a practiced eye. "Get ready to go." Yusuf turns back to the man. "Can you stand?" He sheaths his unbloodied sword and offers his hands. The man disregards him, eyes darting around at the bodies surrounding them. "Come on," Yusuf says, reaching out for the hand not holding the dagger. The man scurries back a step before he can touch, but he does rise to his feet, which is what Yusuf wanted anyway. The man's gaze keeps going back to the dead dog with the arrow through its eye. Quinn leans closer to Yusuf. "We'll leave the bodies," she says in an undertone. "We need to get far away fast." "Does Gabor have anyone who will want revenge?" Yusuf asks before remembering he knows just as much as she does. She glances back over her shoulder at something. "I don't know." Then she walks away, slipping around Yusuf's mount. Noticing movement out of the corner of his eye, Yusuf turns around and blinks. The man is still holding his dagger, of course, but with his other hand, he's now fiddling with a bloodied crossbow bolt. He must have picked it up off the ground where Yusuf dropped it. The man is staring at Yusuf's hip, at the red-stained tear where the bolt went in. Yusuf lifts his shirt to show his smooth, if bloodied, skin. "All healed," he says with a smile. The man tilts his head in what almost looks like a nod, eyes dropping back down to the bolt in his hand. "Come on," Yusuf says, waiting for the man to look up again before he gestures. "Let's get away from this mess, They walk out from behind the relative shelter of the horses directly into the midst of the bodies. Yusuf holds in a sigh at the sight. So much death. All for the sadistic whims of a wealthy bastard. It's not until the man freezes in place that Yusuf realizes the women didn't kill everyone. The big horse is nowhere to be seen, but its rider lies on his back in the grass. Both his hands are placed gingerly around the arrow shaft protruding from his crotch. Blood stains his fingers and his body trembles as he groans. His protective instinct screaming, Yusuf takes a half step to the side to shield the man. "I said I would cut it off," Quinn says coldly. She cocks her head to one side in exaggerated thought. I suppose this is good enough. Gabor curses at her, his teeth gritted against the pain. This is nothing compared to what you did to him, Yusuf growls. He is nothing but a beast, Gabor hisses, his eyes wild. I own him. I can do whatever I want to him. Not anymore, Yusuf interrupts. Never again. He reaches back for the man's wrist, careful to choose the hand holding the crossbow bolt so as to not effectively disarm him. He should see his torturer laid low, Yusuf thinks. He tugs gently to urge the man forwards, remaining close to his side. The man fixes his wide eyes on Gabor, lips pressed tightly together and jaw clenched. He makes no attempt to move closer. Catching sight of him, Gabor lets out a wheezing laugh. What then? Are you going to sick him on me? He demands, half-crazed smile marring his face. Even better, have him kill me with my own sword. I thought you didn't allow him weapons, Andromache says, calmly cleaning her axe with a piece of cloth, no doubt torn from a corpse. She looks like she's willing to stand there all day while Gabor writhes weakly in pain. He is a weapon, Gabor shrugs one shoulder, huffing out a ragged breath. But he did come with this one. Yusuf exchanges a confused look with Quinn before understanding strikes him across the face. That's his sword, he asks. He lets go of the man's wrist to clench his fists. His anger grows with his voice as he speaks. You've been wearing his sword this whole time. His eyes travel up and down the scabbard of the blade still strapped to Gabor's hip, trying to recognize it from those bare few seconds at Al-Quds. Quinn kicks Gabor's foot, jostling his leg and making him groan. So that's what you meant that night, she says with narrowed eyes. You thought disarming him made him more dangerous, but it didn't. You made him more dangerous by how you treated him. Gabor tries to speak, but Yusuf doesn't want to hear his voice anymore. You stripped him of everything that made him human, he says harshly. Freedom, dignity, comfort. What did you not take? He struggles to find the right words to voice his disgust. Did you wear his clothes, too, or are they hanging somewhere in your halls? Gabor doesn't answer, his breath labored, sweat shines on his brow. Hey, Andromache calls quietly, eyes on the man at Yusuf's side. He looks up at Yusuf's nudge to his shoulder. She sends him a smile, a gentle expression at odds with the weapon in her hands. You want to do the honors? She deliberately glances at Gabor, then drops her gaze to the dagger in the man's hand. He looks down too, tilting the blade up as he blinks at it, like he's just now realizing it's there. His wide eyes flick back to Gabor. His gaze hardens, but he doesn't move. He lowers the blade and inexplicably turns to Yusuf. Yusuf looks back helplessly, not knowing what to offer him. An explanation in a language he can understand? Reassurance? Encouragement? You could get some revenge, Quinn says, toying with her bow and eyeing the arrow in Gabor's dick with satisfaction. Gabor coughs out a laugh. Beasts know nothing of revenge, he says. Only violence. You be quiet, Quinn snaps, kicking him again. Yusuf gestures to Gabor, lying helpless with none of his men or his wealth to protect him. What do you want to do? He touches the underside of the man's wrist with just enough pressure to lift his hand a fraction, pointing the dagger's tip towards the groaning man on the ground. The man shakes his head in a tiny side-to-side movement, taking a tentative step back. He watches Yusuf for a reaction, a wrinkle between his eyebrows. It's all right, Yusuf says softly, taking his arm and drawing him a few steps further back to underline his words. You don't have to. We won't make you kill anyone. It seems like such a low expectation to set, and yet... He shoots a glare back at Gabor. Yusuf nearly startles away when he feels fingers hesitantly brushing against his. The man's eyes are once again fixed on Gabor, but his hand is hovering over Yusuf's where it still rests on his arm. The crossbow bolt lies abandoned on the ground. It's the first nonviolent touch he's ever initiated. Something euphoric swells in Yusuf's chest at the realization, cooling his anger. He hesitantly brings up his other hand and rests it on the man's upper back. After a brief flinch, the man settles. It could be Yusuf's imagination, but he thinks the man even leans into his touch just a little. The moment is broken by Gabor's feeble jeering. "Look at him! He can't even get near me!" Gabor jerks when Quinn takes a step closer, then sneers at them to save face. "He is too afraid! He can't kill me!" Andromache shares a glance with Quinn, then looks to Yusuf, checking to see if they're all right, if they're ready. Yusuf nods. Lastly, Andromache's attention shifts to their fourth member. Her stoic facade cracks, and Yusuf can see the concern and fierce protectiveness in her gaze. As the silence draws out, the man tears his eyes from his torturer and blinks guilelessly at Andromache. Their gaze holds for a long moment. Whatever she sees, she nods to herself like a question has been answered. Breaking their stare, she strides forward to tower over Gabor's prone figure. "He doesn't have to kill you," Andromache says simply. "We're here now to do it for him." Without another word, she raises her axe and swings it down on Gabor's neck with all her might. The man jolts in Yusuf's grasp as the axe thuds into the ground. Andromache steps back with a grimly satisfied look and begins to clean her axe all over again. Quinn aims another kick before stepping away. The man remains where he is, staring at the body. "It's over," Yusuf tells him, hesitantly rubbing his hand in tiny circles on the man's upper back. "He's dead. It's over." The man steps away from Yusuf, approaching Gabor slowly. He stops a pace away, as though afraid the corpse might sit up and grab for him. The head has lolled away from the rest of the body, blood pooling in the dirt. Yusuf waits where he is, not sure what to expect. After a long minute of utter stillness, the man looks back at him. His eyes are huge and uncertain, his mouth twisted. His free hand creeps up to cup his throat. "No, no, none of that," Yusuf says, stepping forward to gently pull the hand away. He holds on to it, daring to lace their fingers together, and his heart jumps into his throat when the man doesn't pull away. He finds a smile for the man and tugs at their joined hands. "Come, let's get away from here." The man follows without protest, but he keeps turning to look at Gabor's body. "Let's not forget," Quinn says. She crouches by the corpse and unbuckles the belt, sword and dagger and all. She holds it all out to the man with a pleased look. "I believe this is yours." Yusuf lets go of the man's hand, and he runs it over the plain sheath with something like reverence. He even lets Yusuf wrap the belt around his hips and buckle it, though he tenses with Yusuf's hands so close to his crotch. "There," Yusuf says, stepping back as soon as he's done. The man pulls Gabor's bejeweled dagger from the belt and carelessly drops it to the ground, sheathing Yusuf's blade in its place. Yusuf exchanges an amused look with Quinn. Then the man is drawing his sword in one smooth motion, both hands gripping its hilt with the familiarity of countless practice. He holds it aloft, body automatically sinking into a ready stance, sun glinting off the blade. Suddenly, a shadow of the crusader stands before them, tall and proud, determined and dangerous. He awaits a worthy opponent. His eyes shine with conviction. He holds death in his hands. Yusuf blinks and the image is gone, leaving only a starved, mute man whose arms are trembling under the weight of his own sword. "Come," Yusuf says, moving in close to touch the man's wrist. He is unafraid of the blade. The man blinks at him and lowers the sword, sheathing it after two shaky attempts. There is something more settled about him, a slight weight lifted from his broad shoulders, a surety to his straightened spine. He glances back to Gabor's body once more. His jaw tightens, his eyes flinty. Then he very deliberately turns his back and heads for his horse. Yusuf meets Quinn's gaze, their smiles growing. Hope is bursting bright and happy within him, no doubt shining out from his face. Progress, he thinks. We'll make it. We'll get him back. Andromache's voice calls to them. Are you coming or not? She moves her horse to stand side by side with the man's, grinning at him when he doesn't flinch away from her. Yes, Yusuf answers. He swings up onto his horse and settles in the saddle, ready for wherever the road leads them next. Let's go. Chapter 18. Waiting. These new people are very good at waiting. It's been days, and he knows this because he's seen the sun rising and setting, beautiful sunlight without even a single death match to force his eyes from the skies. And yet they have not chained him up, have not taken a weapon or a hand to him, not in punishment at least, and no one has forced touch on him at all since he defended himself against the man in the river. He is not sure how he feels about the man's touch later, a hand on his back, fingers intertwined with his. It was different, strange. It didn't hurt. He is good at waiting, too. He has long since learned how to let time stretch out without stretching him thin. But their game is making him anxious. They tell him where to go with hand gestures and smiles, ushering him towards a horse and expecting him to follow. He does. Where else is he going to go? If he runs, they will catch him. He never manages to escape when he runs. And he saw what they did to all those men. They will cut him down if he tries, and then he will have earned their ire. No, he will wait until they make their move, and then he will fight. Maybe they are saving him for something special, waiting until he lets down his guard, and only then will they strike, relishing in the color of his blood and the sounds that will inevitably escape his throat. Maybe they don't know he will heal from even the worst they could do. But no. The man watched him during his last fight. He must have seen the wounds closing and death spitting him back out. Then what are they waiting for? Even Gabor never waited this long, he doesn't think, not while he continued to visit. Gabor is dead. The uncertainty of when they will finally hurt him is weighing over his head at all times. It pushes him to constant vigilance, exhausting himself with eyes alert tracking three people with no wall at his back, except sometimes his attention lapses. He falls asleep. The food in his hand and in his mouth overcomes all other needs. He is distracted by the way the wind moves tall stalks of grass, gently undulating, vibrant green, so beautiful and free. And when he snaps back into focus, gaze darting around to see what threat is approaching, there never is one. It's making him sick. He pats the neck of the horse that has been carrying him, calming himself with the softness of her fuzzy skin and the placid way she stands there accepting his touch. He liked horses before. He is glad they have not changed. Not like dogs. He used to like dogs, too. The sun is going down again, miraculous in its movement and its visibility. He doesn't watch it for long, always careful to check his surroundings. The tall woman is building a fire. The man is out of sight, having left with all the water skins some time ago. The shorter woman is also nowhere to be seen. They are amidst trees, but there is no real shelter here. No bushes, no thickets, no wall for his back. He stays with the horses. The woman glances over as she reaches for another handful of sticks. He tries not to shrink away. Weakness is exploited. He recognizes the look in her ice-cold eyes. This is a person who knows strength and weakness, who knows how to wield advantages ruthlessly. She has proven she can kill him easily, when he is held down at least, and he saw all the bodies she left behind. He did not see much of the battle. His eyes were somewhere else, staring into the past as his ears rang with the barking of dogs and yells of the crowd. His grip on the dagger reminded him of the present, his fingers painfully tight on the hilt. He never had a weapon back then. He followed the sensation back down a brightening tunnel until he blinked and saw the man standing in front of him, blade drawn but not brandished in his direction. Men who were not him were screaming. And then they were not. She was there, axe dripping blood, unbothered by the death she dealt out. She could kill him with that blade so easily, just as she killed Gabor. Gabor is dead. She looks away again, and he can breathe. She carries something ancient and godlike within her. Her hands are strong and wreak violence with ease. She has only killed him once, and it did not hurt. She looks at him like he is something fragile, but she doesn't try to break him. She never seems to view his staring as aggression or impudence. None of them do. Or if they do, they are biding their time with his punishment. The tall woman mostly ignores his gaze. The short woman likes to stare back, her face stretched in a smile that so far has not been a prelude to any pain. The man likes to stare too, but only when not being stared at in return. He can feel the man's eyes on his face while they ride, as they eat, when they sit around at night doing nothing. The attack will come from the man first. He is too obviously interested, always watching and tugging on the cloak and placing the bedrolls close together, and men are always worse. The man gave up at the river for now, but he will try again. He must. They always do. The man's voice is soft, and his hands bring no pain. His eyes are so warm and deep. He gave the gift of a cloak and demanded no recompense. He broke the chains and did not lead him to his death. He buried the rabbit with gentleness. He is not like Gabor. Gabor is dead. Soft footfalls warn him of the man's return. He strides back into view, eyes scanning the campsite as he makes for the woman. The man hands her a water skin, then turns and begins to approach. The water calls to him. He is always thirsty, his throat perpetually dry and choking, his stomach never forgetting the cramping and pain. The man offers a water skin with a smile and a few words. He takes it and drinks immediately. The man's smile remains as he steps back safely out of reach. He wants to duck behind his hair, hiding from that steady gaze that he used to see in his dreams, but he has no hair to do it with. They sat him down yesterday. He knows it was yesterday, because he got to see the sun set and then rise on today, a simple thing he will never take for granted again, and pulled out a pair of scissors. The shorter woman cut the taller's hair first, neatly lopping off the ends, and then they traded places. He watched in silence, not sure why he had to sit here instead of with the horses. The man came next, holding still as the shorter woman took the scissors to his head. Tiny snippets of curls fell to the ground, leaving behind a beard that looked much the same as when they began. Then the woman turned to him. He tensed as the blades neared his head, but they were all around him, ready for any move he tried to make. Maybe they only wanted to cut his hair, he thought. They did that sometimes, back before. The woman kept up a constant stream of noise as she clipped. Whole locks of hair fell from his head, which felt lighter with every tangled mass that dropped. Her fingers skimmed his ears as she trimmed close to his scalp. He held his taut muscles very still, but for his nervous fingers, stroking the hilt of the dagger in his belt. He could not easily draw his sword while seated, but the dagger could buy him time to get to his feet. He had weapons. He had a chance. He would wait. He is good at waiting. Once his head felt chilled without hair over his ears or the nape of his neck or his forehead, she moved on to his beard. This she trimmed even shorter, until he nearly had no beard at all. He kept his mouth shut tight. When his mole was no longer hidden by encrusted hair, She said something quietly, smiling, and brushed a fingertip over it. He could not stop his flinch at the touch. She finished without another word, and his nerves jangled with the mistake that he would pay for later. Now the breeze ruffles through his short hair and smooths across his uncovered face. He lifts his head into it, feeling addicting after so long in still, stale air. The shorter woman returns with a pair of large birds swinging at her hips, arrows still in their breasts. She drops them by the fire that has flared up fully, squatting on her haunches. The man finally walks away, leaving him alone with the horses. The three of them sit around the fire and talk. He pets the horse and waits, eyes flicking from one face to another. The sun is rapidly disappearing. Darkness begins to press in on them, at once horrifying and familiar. Moonlight is his only solace at night. And now this campfire. Its glow shimmers against the shorter woman's long, dark hair. She is the only one who has not killed him yet. It's only a matter of time. He should be extra wary of her, of what excruciating way she will choose to kill him after waiting this long. And he is wary, watching her as carefully as the others. But to his confusion, he also feels something not negative. No one else has known him this long without killing him, not since before Gabor. Gabor is dead. She sees him watching and she sends him yet another smile. She doesn't smile this much at the others, only him. The attention makes him uncomfortable. She says something to the others and rises, heading his way. He draws his spine up tight, ready to use his greater height and weight to his advantage. As usual, she stops just out of arm's reach, bouncing a little on light feet. She starts to speak while staring at him. The sounds vary from time to time, sometimes a series of harsh syllables half bitten off, sometimes twanging, sometimes rising and falling like so many verses of a song. He's not sure why she does this. People speak to give him instructions, and not even that, after the language he knew faded away, and only incomprehensible words filled his ears, or, he guesses, to taunt him as they take their pleasure from his pain. But she doesn't ever grow angry when he does nothing in response, and she isn't hurting him. Is she talking to her companions, making plans for him, maybe? She has not killed him. She cut his hair without presenting him to anyone after, and she led him to his first sunset, and she sings to him with a smile. Then she says something all soft and smooth, lilting and fluid. It goes through his body like a tiny shock, a part of his brain inexplicably perking up and taking notice. He twitches, his eyes widening in his confusion. She pauses, then says the same thing again. He flinches back this time, stepping away from the horse. He's not sure why these words are making his body respond, and anxiety begins to build at the new sensation. She isn't calling him Beast. She isn't saying a name he recognizes instinctively, not like when the man spoke of Jerusalem and his former masters. She can't be speaking to him, not really, because words are not for him to comprehend. Speech is just noise, a side effect of pain. His breath is coming faster. What is she saying? She steps closer, says something else, more words that slip easily into his ears and twinge an atrophied muscle in his head. There's a long-forgotten feeling hiding just beyond the thinning fog in his mind. Understanding glimmering in the distance, familiar and terrifying. She is speaking to him. He is meant to hear and respond. His mouth is unbound. His tongue is free. His ears are not bleeding. Beasts do not speak. These words are for him. He stumbles back from the speech that he is so close to distinguishing meaning from. Something is touching his ears, squeezing them close to his head, his own hands tight and shaking. She is growing taller, her eyes wide, her mouth moving faster, though he can't hear her anymore. Or he is growing smaller, the ground suddenly within reach, his knees brushing his shoulders. His body trembles, struggling to balance, crumpled on the balls of his feet. His breath is ragged, coming fast and painful in his throat. He wants to be away from here, wants to escape from the words this woman is making just for his ears. What will it mean? Once he can understand. He hasn't understood since... Gabor is dead. He used to speak. He exchanged sentences with his previous masters, the holders of his leash, and it did nothing. Gabor is dead. But these words dig deeper than anything he has felt in years, touching something inside himself he thought was long gone, traveling back in time to reach the ears of a much younger man. As a last resort, he squeezes his eyes shut to block out the woman's mouth, still shaping sounds that are disorientingly familiar. What is she saying? Where has he heard this? He must not speak. He must not hear. He is not free to comprehend. On and on, his thoughts whirl in dizzying paths inside his clamoring head, wordless and panicked and uncertain. He can feel his own lips moving without his control. He should open his eyes. He isn't safe here. But his breath is tearing chunks from his chest, and he doesn't understand. A touch to his shoulder makes him flinch back, his hands automatically dropping from his head to catch himself on the ground as he falls backwards. Then his eyes are open, frantically taking in the sights he should not have dared to ignore. The shorter woman, face tight, standing with her mouth closed. The taller woman standing beside her, a hand on her hip, and piercing gaze on him. The man crouched before him, a hand outstretched, and those bottomless eyes wrapping him up and holding him still. The man makes a noise, quiet and meaningless. His hand reaches out again, inexorable and gentle. It's not until fingers brush against his cheek that he realizes his own lips are still moving. A sound spilling from him over and over again. No, 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 no. He snaps his mouth shut. His breath is heaving in and out through his nose. The man's fingers are soft on his cheekbone, wiping wetness from his skin. The women stay where they are. Will they punish him now? Has he found their limit? Is the wait over? He is tired of waiting. It takes time for his breath to slow, for his heart to cease pounding so furiously, for him to stop flinching at every sound from the woods around them. The three of them watch. They wait. As the adrenaline fades, so too does his energy. The strength drains from his body. He sags, limbs falling limp. His arms struggle to hold his weight any longer. The man speaks to him, but the sounds mean nothing, not triggering any hazy sense of comprehension from the depths of his mind. A steady hand urges him to his feet and leads him to a bedroll by the crackling fire. He nearly collapses onto it, exhausted. He shies away from his thoughts and rolls to place his back to the fire, the best defense he has in this open campsite. Never turn your back. They will get you from behind. The man says something else, murmuring in his smooth voice. He sits on the ground within sight, not touching. The firelight gleams in his brown eyes. He watches it flicker. He wraps his arms around himself, though he is not cold. He lets his ears fill with meaningless speech that he is not expected to understand. He lies still and breathes and listens until the night sweeps in to drag him down into sleep. When he wakes again, it is still nighttime. He doesn't move, ears straining against the silence and eyes straining against the dark. He hears and sees nothing moving. There is a soft red glow tinting faded shadows before him. a crackle behind him. The fire burned low and banked. He hears something shift close by and cranes his neck to see. The man sits with his back to the fire, facing away into the trees. He sits up slowly, only registering the blanket draped over him once it has fallen to his lap with a soft rustle. He is always cold. He is not granted warmth or softness. He is given nothing without consequences. Until now. The man turns around and sees him awake. He smiles, says something quiet, and reaches to his side for something. A quick glance shows the women sleeping in each other's arms on the other side of the fire. It's disorienting still to see people making themselves so vulnerable within his reach. Don't they know he could kill them? Don't they know it's not safe to fall asleep? He focuses back on the man as he reaches out, something in his proffered hand, a stick, skewering a chunk of roasted meat. He blinks at it. His mouth waters at the thought of food, like it always does now that he has water to drink, but he takes the meat with reluctance. When they all eat together, he watches the others to be sure they are eating the same things as him before he takes a bite. Now that he can stand to wait a few seconds before eating, his guts no longer cramping around nothing. He is wary of this food held aside for him. But in the end, he can't stop himself, his instinct screaming at him to eat. He tears off a large bite as the man watches, his head jerking to rip the tough meat from the bone. Once he starts, he can't stop. God, the hunger! It aches. The man turns back to stare into the darkness. He only looks over again once the meat is gone, handing over a water skin. He gulps down water, fresh and clean and invaluable. Sated, he fiddles with the greasy bone and blinks back at the man. He feels settled, complacent. His stomach is full. His clothes and the fire are keeping him warm. And no one is hurting him. The man has not hurt him, not since they killed each other. Their gaze holds, draws out. The man's face shifts through several unreadable but distinct expressions, eyebrows moving and mouth twitching. Then the man is speaking, one hand resting on his own chest. The syllables are fluid and smooth-edged like the woman's were before, and he braces himself. But they're different, too. Stiff. Some of the sounds seem off, in a way he can't explain. He cocks his head to one side as though he can angle the sounds into their correct places. He focuses on the curious feeling of wrongness, of awkwardness, as the man's lips wrap around the same shapes again and again. It is then, listening to the practiced, imperfect speech in that warm, gentle voice, that the muscle in his head finally flexes, and the fog burns away, and the sounds leap from his ears to his brain, down a remembered pathway, and suddenly, "My name is Yusuf." He sucks in a sharp breath. The man stops speaking. They stare at each other. He understood. The words were meant for him, and said in a way he could understand, and he heard. And the words didn't hurt. Words always hurt. His gaze drops to the man's hand on his chest, then darts back up to those deep eyes, shining large beneath slightly raised eyebrows. Beasts do not speak, but neither do they understand. If he can do the latter, he opens his mouth slowly, carefully, his lips moving and throat working as he fights the phantom feeling of the muzzle stilling his tongue, and he says, "Yusuf." The man's eyes grow impossibly wider. Nothing happens for several heartbeats. Then the man, then Yusuf, because that is what he said, those words' meanings finally revealing themselves, smiles. He smiles. His lips curving gently at first, then splitting to reveal straight teeth, the apples of his cheeks growing and the corners of his eyes crinkling until his entire face seems to shine with delight. "Yusuf," the man repeats, tapping his chest and nodding enthusiastically. Then Yusuf extends his arm out, hand changing directions to point away from himself, to point at him. "My name is," Yusuf says in that stilted, accented way. His eyebrows go up. "My name is." He stares, confused. He understands this speech. Yusuf is speaking to him, and he understands, but Yusuf is leaning forward, and then a finger lightly taps his chest. He doesn't flinch, too caught up in the words. "My name is." "My name is?" A name. Just for him. Like these words are meant for him. He searches through the same place in his head, dusty and haphazard and nearly forsaken. The thoughts of a younger man. Not a beast. Someone who came before it all. Before Emil. Before Gabor. Gabor is dead. One who could hear and could speak, who wore clothes and a sword, who rode a horse and sailed ships, who killed Yusuf what feels like a long time ago. That man had a name. Can he be that man again? "My name," he rasps, the words rolling off his tongue with startling ease. He takes another drink of water to ease his aching throat, the man's eyes never leaving his face. What is his name? It has been so long since he had one. He tries again. He doesn't know the end of the sentence until he reaches it. "My name is Nicolo." Yusuf's smile brings sunrise early. "Nicolo," he repeats, his voice tender and breathy. He says it again, then again, asking for nothing, causing no harm, just giving. Nicolo listens to his name spoken aloud for the first time in years. It feels like getting a piece of himself back that he didn't know was gone. Like food for a starving stomach, like a candle in the dark. Tears are dripping steadily from his wide eyes, but nothing hurts. Yusuf says something new, stumbling over the syllables. It takes two tries to interpret. "You are safe," Yusuf says clumsily. He reaches out a careful hand and rests it atop Nicolo's in his lap. "You are safe, Nicolo. You are safe, Nicolo." Staring into Yusuf's earnest eyes, Nicolo hears the words meant just for him. He hesitantly turns a hand over to hold Yusuf's, warm and solid and soft. He listens, and he starts to believe. The end.